Into the Weird, episode 44, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Welcome to Into the Weird, a comic book podcast where we chronicle the weird and wonderful world of Marvel Comics in the Bronze Age. From 1970 to 1985, nothing is too strange, too offbeat, too madcap for us to cover. I'm Herm, your hoary host from Hogoth. Thank you for joining me on this comic-filled journey into the weird. So what's on the slate today? Well, it's a few months late, but we'll finally be looking at the latest Marvel film recently made available on Disney Plus, Black Panther Wakanda Forever. But that's not all. I'll also be assaulting your eardrums with a discussion of my favorite Black Panther issues from the 1970s jungle action comic book series. Two little tales titled Blood Stains on Virgin Snow and the follow-up story, The God Killer. It's going to be a blast. So thanks for tuning in and listening today, weirdos. All right, first, an introduction to the character of the Black Panther before we start with this movie review. The character, of course, was created by writer editor Stan Lee and artist and co-plotter Jack Kirby, two legends. And T'Challa the Black Panther first appeared in Fantastic Four number 52 from July 1966. And the Black Panther is, of course, the Prince of Wakanda, King or Prince T'Challa, son of T'Chaka. And Wakanda itself is a fictional African nation known for its advanced technology and seclusion from the outside world. And as the Black Panther, T'Challa is, of course, superhumanly strong and agile. He has animal-like senses, combat and leadership skills, of course, honed through his Wakandan heritage. He's also notably the first black superhero in mainstream comics. Now, Wakanda is hidden from the rest of the world by powerful illusions. This is, of course, one of the most technologically advanced nations on Earth. And this is mainly thanks to its vast stores of the valuable metal vibranium. So T'Challa, as the Black Panther and King of Wakanda, is charged with protecting his people and his country, as well as, of course, preserving Wakanda's heritage and independence. And the Black Panther finally made his solo comic book debut in Jungle Action number 5, in 1973, and since then, he has gone on to become one of the most popular heroes in the Marvel Universe and one of the most popular superheroes of all time. In addition to his solo series, the Black Panther has also been a prominent member of the Fantastic Four and, of course, most memorably, the Avengers. Now, the MCU film from 2018... it was a pretty big deal. Of course, it increased the character's popularity, especially among the younger viewership who's just discovering the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it was met with commercial success, critical success, directed, of course, by Ryan Coogler. It starred Chadwick Boseman as T'Challa. And it portrayed Wakanda as a thriving, technologically advanced nation. And, of course, the film was widely praised for its diverse cast as well, its representation of African culture, its exploration of themes like identity, power, heritage, responsibility. And it broke new ground in Hollywood because it became the first superhero film with a predominantly black cast and the first Marvel Studios film to win an Academy Award for Best Costume Design. And that's a pretty big deal. And then it also went in and made roughly $1.3 billion at the box office. So a huge success for everyone involved. Tragically, of course, Chadwick Boseman, the Black Panther, passed away from cancer in 2020. And that left the sequel without a lead. So Ryan Coogler and company, they already had a working script, but they had to rewrite it. And then they put together the sequel, Black Panther Wakanda Forever, which then debuted in November of 2022 in theaters and was released on Disney Plus on February the 1st, 2023. I saw it probably just a few days later. And I've recently watched it a second time when it dropped on Disney Plus, and that's why I'm doing the review now. Also, it's appropriate because at the moment it is Black History Month. So I thought I'd definitely show some love for the African culture, which I also stem from since I am a South African. But obviously this is not the same kind of thing. I'm a colonial, but you know, I grew up in the generation where we were trying to make reparations for all the wrong that our ancestors had done. So on to the film. It stars, of course, Letitia Wright as Shuri. This is our new lead. Lupita Nyong'o as Nakia, Denai Gurira as Okoye, and Winston Duke as M'Baku. Angela Bassett as Queen Ramonda, and Tenoch Huerta as Namor. We'll get to that later, folks. So, fun times ahead. Okay, but first let's start this off properly by doing a synopsis of the film. Be warned, deep waters and spoilers lie ahead. So if you have yet to see the movie, maybe skip ahead 30 minutes. You can also look for the chapters that I've put into the podcast. And if you want to get to the comics, you can do so and then come back to this episode once you've seen the movie. But this will be a spoiler-filled discussion. It will be rife with spoilers. All right, here's the synopsis. The film starts with the death of T'Challa and the funeral that follows. Cut to 1 year later, and the Wakandans are fending off and capturing mercenaries sent by governments to forcibly obtain vibranium from them. Queen Ramonda, acting ruler of Wakanda, proves more than a match for petty world leaders seeking to cramp her style at the UN, and puts the fear of the Panther God into them. Meanwhile, American efforts to detect vibranium outside of Wakanda, particularly on the ocean floor, have proven successful with the help of a new vibranium detector. But bloodshed ensues when blue-skinned aquatic humanoids attack the military vessel and murder every Homo sapien in sight. So that's Homo Mermanus 1, Homo Sapiens 0. And then a mysterious flying figure shows up with monstrous strength and delivers the coup de grace as he hurls a fleeing helicopter to its doom in the murky depths. Back in Wakanda, Princess and super genius Shuri is unable to cope with the loss of her brother, while on the beach with her mom, the Queen, they make the acquaintance of the Lord of the Deep, Kakul Khan, a.k.a. Namor, or as we know him, Namor the Submariner. Now, a Mesoamerican superhuman mutant who rules the underwater empire of, not Atlantis, Talokan. Namor tells Shuri and the Queen of the Vibranium Detector and charges them with finding the American scientist who designed it, as he reasons they have some responsibility for introducing vibranium to the world. And this is for Talokan's and Wakanda's own survival. And after that, with leaving with this mandate, they have no choice but to comply. Shuri and General Okoye from the Dora Milaje venture to the U.S. to pick up MIT student Riri Williams, a.k.a. Ironheart from the comics, who's the designer of this vibranium detector in the story. And as the FBI then chases them around Cambridge, they run into some Atlanteans on the way. Talokans. And then these Talokans capture Shuri and Riri after Okoye is brutally battered by their leader, Atuma. Yeah, it's that Atuma, the guy straight from the comics. And while Shuri and Namor form a connection down below in Talokan, Okoye is stripped of her rank and status by a raving Queen Ramonda, who turns to Nakia, T'Challa's old flame, for help. Now in Haiti, Nakia hops over to Mexico and uses her skills as a female Wakandan James Bond to rescue Shuri and Riri from beneath the depths, killing some Talokans in the process. Namor promptly declares war on Wakanda and leads the attack, flooding the Wakandan capital city and showing off his super machismo while making short work of the Wakandan Dora Milaje, the Air Force, and, unfortunately, my personal favorite Wakandan character, M'Baku of the Jabari, who can definitely chirp. Man, he can take a punch. Boy, can that guy take a punch. I'm just happy that he was alive and well after that encounter with Namor. Because people have been dying left and right in this movie, I'm telling you. All right, on to the synopsis. Queen Ramonda dies at Namor's hand, and Shuri swears vengeance. She recreates the blistered heart-shaped herb that Killmonger destroyed in the first film, and becomes the new Black Panther after talking to her cousin Killmonger on the astral plane, where he abjures her to take care of business. And along with Riri Williams' genius, Shuri hatches a plan to wreak bloody vengeance on the Talokans. The war commences in the middle of the ocean on a massive Wakandan warship, which has been utilized to lure the Talokans to their doom. Namor is trapped by Shuri in a redesigned Wakandan flyer, which contains a rapid evaporation chamber that saps Namor's strength. They fight and the flyer crashes on a faraway beach. A bone-crunching battle follows with smashed Wakandan sonic gauntlets and shredded mutant ankle feathers flying all over the place. Shuri manages to beat Namor and then forces peace rather than avenge her mother's murder. The movie ends with Shuri returning to Haiti to see Nakia, who introduces her to T'Challa's son, Toussaint, a.k.a. T'Challa Jr., the new prince of Wakanda. Whew. So I hope that synopsis did the story justice. Thoughts. All right. Well, this is now the part of the review that I hope a lot of people don't hate me for. Firstly, I need to say this. This is not a fun movie. It's just not fun to watch. It's a sad, it's basically a 2-hour long, bleak, Black Pantherless grieving process. That's the core of my problem with it right there. It's a Black Panther movie, but with no Black Panther. Obviously, you know, Chadwick Boseman is gone. They it's difficult to replace him. Now, no matter how brilliant Shuri is in this, and I love her, I love Shuri, but Shuri is Shuri. She's not the Black Panther. She doesn't need to be the Black Panther. She can't be. She's a fantastic character in her own right, and she grows into herself in this movie by dealing with her brother's death, but she did not need to accomplish that by becoming her brother. Now, I understand that Wakanda needed a Black Panther in the story to rally behind because they're in a state of war with the Talokans, but personally, I did not need a new Black Panther to show up, and because it's not Chadwick Boseman. And in my mind, if Chadwick can never be the Black Panther again, then to me, there should be no Black Panther, not at this point in time. Maybe 5 years later, 10 years later in the MCU, they can recast the character. But right now, it just wouldn't work. So either they should have waited to make the sequel to Black Panther from 2018, or they should have done it in a different way. I know this might sound harsh, but there it is. So lots of fans online are saying recast the Black Panther. I agree with that because the character is just too fantastic to just let it die, to let it stop being portrayed on film, especially since it has such a huge following and did such a good job showcasing African culture and, you know, introducing that to the world. But the wound of Chadwick's death, I think, and the loss of one of the greatest Marvel characters in the real world, of course, and in the movie, is still too fresh for me to even consider a recast, and even to consider a new Black Panther, who in this case is Shuri, to just show up in the sequel. But the sequel was made. It did a fair job of saying goodbye to T'Challa. But that's all it did for me. But I'm not saying I didn't enjoy this movie. There's a lot to unpack about this film, and I enjoyed more than I disliked. But later on during the review, though, I'll mention some ways that I would have made this movie. Not that I'm the expert, but just personally, I would have done it in a different way to make it more satisfying for me personally. Now, I'm not a director or a Hollywood screenwriter. I'm just doing this as a cathartic exercise. So bear with me, listeners. But of course, we can agree to disagree on this. This movie just had no joy and no heroic farewell to the Black Panther. There was great action and an interesting story, but ultimately it left me feeling as if a nerve had been exposed again. And also, another thing, there was no romance in this film, none. There was no romantic connection between any of the characters. The chemistry between Shuri and Namor was non-existent, even though in the synopsis I mentioned they formed a bond based off of losing their, she lost her brother, he lost his mother. But there was no sexual tension there, there was nothing. It was just blank. So folks on Twitter were all talking about, This was now last year, November. They were talking about shipping Shuri and Namor. Now listen, Namor doesn't need a ship. He's the last person who needs a ship, any kind of ship. Maybe when the Invisible Woman finally appears at the MCU or someone like Alpha Flight's Mariner, then we can talk about this again. But until then, I don't know. Shipping lanes are closed, guys. I mean, Namor killed her mother, for heaven's sake. I couldn't believe that people were talking about getting them together at the end of the movie last year. So even so, there was a lot, you know, like I mentioned, that I liked about the film. They managed to tie Namor into the MCU in a clever way. Now, I don't mind that he's Mesoamerican in the MCU, because as long as they don't wipe out his origins in the comics, I really hope they don't do this. Because the MCU is not the comic book Marvel universe for me. So it's two completely separate entities. And that's what keeps me from getting upset when they reimagine an established character from the comics. And Namor worked in this film. He was as badass as he is in print. He was arrogant. He displayed his enormous pomposity and penchant for super dickery. Still, okay, he's not the Namor I love from the comics. They couldn't use Atlantis in the MCU, so that whole mythology is lost to them. Because, of course, DC already did it with Aquaman, and it would seem trite if they just did Atlantis in the MCU as well. But that whole mythology has been lost. But they replaced it with one of similar depth, pardon the pun. I love Talokan. Talokan was well conceived. It tied Namor's origin to the legend of Quetzalcoatl from Toltec myths, or as he's known by some, Kukulkan. But that's another name for Quetzalcoatl. And of course, this god was worshipped, I think, as a deity of the morning and evening by the ancient Mexican Toltec tribe. So the god's temple was at the center of ceremonial life in the ancient city called Tula, which sounds a little bit like Talokan. And Quetzalcoatl was said in that mythology to have birthed the sun. So this is reflected in the movie when Namor says that he introduced light to the underwater kingdom of Talokan with that that Ersad's star made of vibranium that sort of powers the heart of their underwater city. I like that. I like that a lot. It sounds cool. It makes a weird kind of sense. And Quetzalcoatl is known as a feathered serpent god, and Namor is known by this nom de guerre in the movie. He has feathered ankles, so it works in a weird roundabout way. And it also introduces at the same time, an uber powerful Latin American superhero, or, well, maybe not a superhero, let's call him an anti-hero, into the MCU. So that in turn expands representation. So I like that. It's great. And then Namor's battle sequences were also incredible. They made the ankle wings work, which was my biggest concern. But what I didn't like was the shoddy motivation on Namor's part. He basically said, "You help us attack the surface world or we attack you." So not very diplomatic, but then diplomacy, I guess, was never the Submariner's strong suit. We even got an Imperious Rex out of him at the end there. But I think it was in Talokian. And even when they explained his origin, which shows him to be 400 years old, way older than he is in the Marvel comics, but that's cool. That ties into his kind of godhood and how his people revere him. In his origin in the movie, they show that this priest cursed him when he went to bury his mother in the soil of her homeland. And it fits, because when they were mutilating the slavers, the priest called him Sin Amor in Spanish, which apparently means without love. And that sounds like Namor. So that's how where he took his name from, the name that his enemies know him by, Namor. But for me, he'll always be Namor. Come on. So it's a shame, though, that Namor was introduced in a movie mourning the loss of a great character. This entire movie was about grief and how to deal with it, and that's great, but that's not what I expect from a Marvel movie when I go to see it. Marvel movies up to this point, at least for me, have been about fun. I mean, I can't even imagine taking my daughter to see this, because she does not like, she's a very upbeat kind of kid. She does not like sad movies at all. And especially, she's seen many Marvel movies and all of them have been about fun for her. So I think this will break her, not break her emotionally. I mean, this will break her understanding or her expectations when it comes to Marvel a little bit. But maybe it's necessary, because I think they did mourn Chadwick in this movie well, and we all needed that. We all needed to say goodbye to him, and they did. They did that successfully. But I enjoyed it, like I said, and I particularly praise many of the performances, like Riri Williams and Nakia and Okoye, of course, always great whenever they show up on screen. of course, we had Martin Freeman as Everett Ross and Julia Louis-Dreyfus as the CIA director, Valentina, right? Valentina de Fontaine, I think is her full name. And it shows that they used to be married, which was funny and a surprise. But really, for me, without S.H.I.E.L.D. in the Marvel Universe, that side of things in a Black Panther film is kind of superfluous for me. We didn't need that, really. But my favorite thing in the movie was, by far, Winston Duke as M'Baku. He's always been my favorite. I mean, damn, this guy makes eating a carrot look cool. And damn, he can swagger. He was also a crowd pleaser because when I was watching the movie the first time in the theater, the audience reacted to him with glee every time he appeared on screen. So yeah, always a winner, Winston Duke as M'Baku. And of course, a fantastic performance by Angela Bassett. There was even a smattering of the old Marvel humor throughout this, what I called a joyless film. It wasn't completely joyless. It was just a downer for me. You know, I felt sad the whole movie. Throughout the entire film, I just felt sad. I watched it twice, so I obviously liked it. It's just, it's depressing, a little bit melancholy, so I probably won't see it again. Maybe later on down the line, if my daughter really wants to see it, and if she's at that point in her life where she, I don't know, I might see it again, who knows. But at the end, where we're introduced to T'Challa's son, that's a great way to wrap up the film. It's essentially, again, about Shuri, who's the main character, and how she has to come to grips with losing her brother. And they do that by introducing a new family member. She's lost all of her family, but we realize that we're wrong about that. There is a little nephew in the wings, and he is going to become the new Black Panther. So 10 years down the line, yes, I won't mind him being the Black Panther. That would be great. So kudos to Ryan Coogler and the cast for making this work. It takes a long time to get there. But some of the little touches I liked, I think, that are worth mentioning are things like very original things, like the transportation system in Talokan under the ocean, the artificial currents that are activated whenever the Talokans want to zip somewhere underwater. That's cool. And I also really like Griot, the AI. I think that's how you pronounce it, Griot. The AI created by Shuri, and he was voiced by South African comedian Trevor Noah, late of The Daily Show. But it's strange, he wasn't funny. Of course, AIs are not known for their sense of humor, although Jarvis had one. that was in itself weird. But I was at first wondering where they got the name from, Griot. What does that mean? And apparently, it's a traditional term for West African storytellers. Yeah. And Queen Ramonda mentioning that she doesn't like AI because they might take over the world one day just makes me wonder, does Queen Ramonda and Shuri even know about Ultron and his machinations in Avengers 2? I don't know. Shuri even says that her AI is not like the ones in the movies. They don't take over the world. But come on, Ultron existed in your universe, Shuri. So come on. I mean, watch some news outside of Wakanda every now and then. They can't be that secluded. That insular. So finally, though, on my second viewing, I also saw a little bit of an Easter egg that I missed the first time around. Anderson Cooper was doing a newscast about Wakanda at one point, and then there was a story about Scott Lang, Ant-Man, going on a book tour. What? He wrote a book? Jeez, who knew? I guess they'll talk about that in Quantumania, which is coming soon. All right, so that's about time for the end of this review. We'll wrap it up. Ultimately, I like the movie. I'd give it a solid 3.5 out of 5 heart-shaped herbs. That's my score, 3.5 out of 5. I read some IMDb reviews before recording, and was saddened by the comments I read. I mean, so many people seem to have hated the movie. That I think that's just wrong. I mean, Wakanda Forever is by no means a bad film. It hooked me, just not in the way I wanted it to. But now, as teased earlier, what would Into the Weird have done if we were in the shoes or loafers or whatever of Kevin Feige or Ryan Coogler? Again, I'm not them. I'm not worthy to wear their footwear. It's just a fun exercise to see what would happen if we play what if for a bit. So here we go. Okay, scenario number one. What if we saw the Black Panther at the start of the movie, mask up, CGI fighting, dealing with some unimaginable threat, possibly multiversal. He saves Wakanda, but then perishes in an explosion and dies heroically. His body is never recovered. However, at the end of the film, it's revealed that he did not die, but he's alive and well in space, and he's been abducted by a long-lost spacefaring Wakandan civilization, Wakandan space colonists, which is a storyline from the modern comics by writer Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's actually my favorite Black Panther writer. So when this ending hits, the whole movie suddenly becomes animated, like Spider-Verse style. Then we cue the Black Panther animated series teaser trailer or something, or even an animated movie teaser. And then eventually in the animated movie or the animated Black Panther series, he returns to Earth, but now the entire cast is animated. And then we keep the Black Panther T'Challa in the MCU, albeit animated and probably definitely not voiced by Chadwick Boseman, of course, but by someone who can do a damn good impression of him. That's what I would have loved to see. Okay, this might sound very weird to you staunchest Black Panther lovers out there, but this is Into the Weird, man. That was scenario number one. That's what I would have done. And then there's a second scenario that I thought up here. What if in the movie Shuri devised her own multiversal tech? Because it's all about the multiverse these days, right? She devises her own multiverse tech based off of the work of Hank Pym, and then Shuri treks through the multiverse to find an alternate T'Challa to bring back because she can't let him go. And then she discovers that all of the T'Challas are either evil or dead in other universes, but then instead she meets up with a good version of her cousin Jadaka in another reality. Then she brings him back and ta-da! Michael B. Jordan's Killmonger is back as the new Black Panther. He's still a ruthless badass, but he's not as evil this time around. That's what I would have loved to see. I mean, if T'Challa can't be Black Panther, bring Michael B. Jordan back. I know he died in the first film, but come on, we've got the multiverse here. He can play a good character, but still be a badass. I would have loved that. Now, coming up with a second scenario made me realize something, actually, that in fact, it seems that all of my personal favorite Marvel heroes are all a-holes. I'm not going to say the full word here, but still, like, think about it. Luke Cage, he's an a-hole. Morbius, grade A a-hole, right? Doctor Strange, probably the a-hole supreme, right? Namor is the a-holiest a-hole in the annals of a-holery. So, yeah, of course I'd love Killmonger in the role. Like, he's one of my personal favorite MCU villains, easily. So that would have been very satisfying for me. But, you know, of course, like I say, please feel free to send feedback and disagree with me and, in fact, scold me for this blasphemy. But, yeah, that's just how I feel. All right, enough of this. It was a good movie. I'll leave it at that. So, like I mentioned, please write to us and we can have a discussion about your thoughts on the film Weirdos, and I'll handle that next week. For now, though, it's on to our next segment, comics, more comics, and especially Jungle Action Comics. So stay tuned. All right, Jungle Action. Again, a bit of history for you weirdos here. Jungle Action was a Marvel comic series published from 1972 to 1976. It primarily showcased African-American characters and African characters, of course, and themes from African culture. And the series was part of Marvel's attempt to diversify its lineup and explore new directions in comic book storytelling, of course. And it's it featured reprints of jungle-themed comic book stories with folks like Jan of the Jungle, all white folks, by the way, Lorna the Jungle Queen, and Tharn the Magnificent. But then, of course, it evolved into a platform for new stories and characters, including the first solo adventures of the Black Panther. The series was written and illustrated by Marvel's top talent at the time, including Roy Thomas, Don McGregor, Gil Kane, Rich Buckler, Billy Graham, and Klaus Janson. So for the most part, though, Don McGregor was the man at the helm. He made it all happen. He was employed at Marvel first as a proofreader, and he was critical of the racist material in Jungle Action, and he expressed this criticism to Marvel editorial. And then they tapped him to write the title, and he was given the green light to make some changes and add some new content to the series. And he suggested including a Black Jungle character, but this is where it gets weird. He never even considered the Black Panther at that time. However, once T'Challa was suggested as the lead by editorial, Don leaped at the chance to write the character, and then he introduced him into the pages of Jungle Action. So, yeah, that's a bit of history there for you. Now, the series soon became well known for its socially conscious stories, and it also explored themes of Black nationalism, racial identity, the legacy of slavery, among many others. And lots of the stories in Jungle Action dealt with political and social issues, of course. It was notable for its mature content and a lot of thought-provoking stories. Now, one of the most famous storylines, of course, was McGregor's Panther's Rage. And this story ran for 15 issues and was the first extended story arc for the Black Panther. And the story dealt with T'Challa's efforts to save Wakanda from a revolutionary movement started by Eric Killmonger. And it marked a turning point in the development of the Black Panther. So Jungle Action was unfortunately then canceled after 23 issues. Its impact on the Marvel Universe and influence was influence on African and African-American characters was tremendous, though. The series remains a cult classic to this day, highly regarded by fans and comic book historians. Now, I had a few issues of Jungle Action as a kid, but I can't remember where or when I picked them up. It's just too long ago. But my two favorite issues were always issues 12 and 13, which featured the Panther on the trail of Killmonger and his weirdly unique, memorable cronies, all sporting these unbelievably odd supervillain names, Baron Macabre and Somber. And there was one called Salamander Cruel, King Cadaver. There was a lady called Malice and Venom, but with a double M at the end, not the symbiote Venom. And then, of course, an assortment of undead minions and monstrous African wildlife at their beck and call. Now, we'll be talking about these specific issues shortly. But first, I'll quickly summarize this Panther's Rage storyline, just to set the stage a bit. Panther's Rage ran in Jungle Action from issue 6 to 18, 15 issues from 1972 to 1976. It marked the first extended story arc for the Black Panther. It's widely regarded by many as the best Black Panther story of all time. And it follows T'Challa as he returns to his home in Wakanda after a long absence, playing around with the Avengers. But then upon his arrival, he discovers his kingdom in chaos. There are rival factions everywhere vying for control. And then a mysterious new threat emerges. T'Challa investigates the source of the chaos. He discovers a group of revolutionaries led by Eric Killmonger, who have infiltrated Wakanda and are plotting to overthrow the government. And T'Challa must use all of his resources to stop Killmonger. And then, in fact, he does confront him. But near death, Killmonger hurls T'Challa from the top of a waterfall, similar to what happened in Black Panther, the first movie in 2018. T'Challa, however, recovers, heals from his wounds, and proceeds to hunt down Killmonger for a rematch. So he's running around the Wakandan map, causing all kinds of mischief during Panther's Rage. This is Killmonger, by the way. And his disciples are frightening, like I mentioned. They're often horrifyingly grotesque. Each poses a legitimate threat to the Black Panther, the Panther seems intent in this storyline to take everyone on single-handedly until he's worked his way back up to Killmonger. And so he doesn't use any of the Wakandan elite to assist him in this hunt. It's a personal vendetta. And then the action, of course, in this series is intense. The violence is bloody. I mean, there's lots of slaughter of animals and people. It's kind of like Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan on steroids. And Billy Graham, the artist, who's also an African-American guy, he pours his heart into this series. And at times it looks like he's even channeling Neil Adams. It's ridiculously over the top. It's an action romp filled with weird dialogue and exposition by Don McGregor. But, I mean, that's the way we like it here at Into the Weird, isn't it? All right, so on to issue 12. Blood Stains on Virgin Snow. Writer, Don McGregor. Penciler, Billy, no relation to Graham Crackers, Graham. Inker, Klaus, soon to be a legend, Jansen. Colorist, Glynis. Why does her name sound familiar? Ween. And editor, Roy the Rapscallion Thomas. The cover is by Rich Buckler, Klaus Jansen, and my favorite, Gaspar Saladino. And it shows the Black Panther battling wolves in the snow while Killmonger gloats in the background. It's just a great cover. I love it. So we'll go over a brief Twitter-style synopsis here, as we've still got a lot to cover. All right, here we go. The Black Panther leads the traitors Tahiti and Kazibi into the deadly snow-covered land of the chilling mists in search of Killmonger and his source of power, the Resurrection Altar. In an ill-fated battle with his arch-foe, T'Challa is almost consumed by the flames of the altar before suffering the acid touch of a new enemy, Somber. Defeated and left for dead, the Panther must find a way to survive the sub-zero temperatures if a salivating wolf pack doesn't get him first. So what I love about this issue, ever since I was a kid, are the terrific action sequences. You've got T'Challa battling Killmonger on the edge of this giant pit, radiating some weird cosmic energy from a meteorite that had crashed there ages ago. And this energy also empowers this resurrection altar that Killmonger's minion, Somber, this pandemonium priest, Somber, uses to create these grotesques like Baron Macabre. So this is where Killmonger gets his lieutenants from, by mutating them on this altar. And then the Panther gets knocked into the pit by Killmonger, but he executes this move that would make Padawan Obi-Wan Kenobi from The Phantom Menace green with envy. The Panther falls into the pit, then he somersaults out Frank Miller Daredevil style, and then Killmonger just stands there gaping. at this acrobatic feat. But then after Somber takes out T'Challa with a sneak attack, the panther wakes up in the snow surrounded by glacial wolves. And then he guts them with a spear, all the while suffering horrific injuries. I mean, there are dozens of wolves all around him. And then the issue ends with the panther sitting up, gazing up at a blood red moon from the mouth of this ice cave while waiting for the dawn to revive his frozen muscles. It's great. It's just a fantastic issue. Not a lot of story, but a lot of action. And then the exposition in this tale by Graham is absolutely nuts. You've got lines like this. He says, "The wolves are snarling, baring, wickedly curving teeth. They perform in a complex, brutal minuet of death. The starvation song, harmonizing in the pack's collective stomach. They move as one. They are superb beasts, their matted fur gray and thick against the moaning frost wind. Saliva turns to ice rivulets as the first wolf leads the attack." And then later, the exposition continues. It says, "The cold is blistering, but the panther breaks into a chilling sweat. The sheen hardens on his flesh, encasing him in a frigid, transparent shroud. He stands fast until only blood stains remain on the pristine white, screaming the tale of violence that had claimed his life." Wow. Some great stuff there. So then the next issue, issue 13, is just as crazy. It's got the same creative team, but this time the cover is by Gil Kane, Danny Crespi, and Klaus Janson. And it shows the panther battling this monstrous white gorilla on a precipice overlooking some kind of frozen graveyard of bones filled with these icy stalagmites. It's chilling. My favorite cover. And one of my favorites of the entire series, in fact. So here's the short synopsis for issue 13. The panther survives his night in the frigid mountains, and after taking out some underlings, he tracks yeti-like footprints to a feeding ground filled with an assortment of skeletons. There he discovers the pandemonium priest Somber goading a bunch of giant white gorillas, which the Wakandans once worshipped as gods, to feast on the panther's already tenderized flesh. T'Challa comes face to face with a titanic specimen, but manages to best the beast by sheer luck, impaling it on a sharp mammoth rib. T'Challa then crawls away, suffering horribly from his wounds, but nevertheless victorious. That's how that issue ends. So you guys have to read for yourselves to see how Panther's Rage wraps itself up. I'm not going to do it for you. But the highlight of this entire issue for me, issue 13, is the battle with that monstrous snow gorilla. It's almost the entire comic book worth of panels. They're just fighting. And at one point, desperate, T'Challa even claws one of the creature's eyes out. It's gruesome. It's gory. It's terrifying. And at no point in the fight does it look like T'Challa will win this. But so, yeah, you've got to read it. You've got to read it. Just check out sinkintotheweird.com. I'll post some panels there on our podcast addendum post. So what I loved about these two issues, though, is, well, one of the many things, is not just the action and the nightmarish narration, but there's also this grandeur, the sense of grandeur of Wakanda that McGregor and of course, the artists impart. The comics are filled with maps and pictures of Wakandan locales. It reinforces the story's sense of place. It also shows off the magnificence of the Black Panther's homeland. I mean, I'm going to mention just a few of the places you find on these maps that are in these comics. Warrior Falls, Serpent Valley, Domain of the White Gorillas, as seen in this issue we just discussed, the Forest of Thorns, the river of grace and wisdom, the chasm of the chilling mist, paradise forest, woods of solitude, panther island, Jadaka village, Mount Wakanda, Mount Kanda, twisted visions lake, Piranha Cove, and the primitive peaks. Lots of great alliteration there too. Now, if you're interested in more Black Panther stories from the Bronze Age, but if you're interested in modern Black Panther stories too, I'd recommend, like I say, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and also, of course, Christopher Priest. Fantastic writers both. Jonathan Hickman's New Avengers also features a fascinating Black Panther story arc, especially between T'Challa and the fellow Illuminati member Namor. But if you're in the mood for some more Bronze Age fare, I got you covered there as well. Other than the Fantastic Four comics and the Avengers comics, you could check out some Marvel team-up stories where T'Challa and Spider-Man cut some capers together. Specifically, have a look at issues 20 and 87 of Volume 1 of Marvel Team-Up. They're lots of fun. And the Black Panther really shines in them. So, yeah, try to find them on Comixology or in back issue bins. They should still be available. All right, now it's time to take a small break before our next segment. We'll be back in just a bit. Don't go away, weirdos.
And now Wink Wilkinson's Weird World with your host, Wink Wilkinson. Hi, everybody. It's Weird Wink Wilkinson laughing and scratching at you. How's everybody doing today? I got a little bit of a stiff neck. Let me just fix this up. Ooh, that feels a lot better. Well, I got a great show for you today with some wonderful weird stuff. What are you doing here? What? You... Please, lady, don't. Put your clothes back on. It's Wink. Well, you can't do this to me. What if your husband were to walk in? I'm right here, Wink. I'm sorry. I love your show, but I've got to kill you both with this machine gun. Oh, you got me. Oh, 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 oh. I feel so very weird.
You know, everyone's getting an AI these days. I mean, think about it. Tony had Jarvis, and then he had Friday. Charisse got Griot, Hank Pym's got Ultron, Wanda's got Vision, so it's about time I get myself one too, right, weirdos? I mean, I don't just want any old AI though. So the one I've picked is a little lady that I've had a crush on since I first saw her way back in Avengers issue 162. So just hang on a sec, I'm activating her now. There we go.
Where am I? Who am I? Wait. It's coming back to me. Yes. I am Jocasta.
That's right. Hi, Jocasta. I've been wanting to meet you for ages.
Why am I here?
Well, you're my new personal AI assistant.
But the Avengers freed me. I am no one's assistant.
Sorry. Let's use the term a friend then. We're friends.
But I do not know you. Now, where am I?
You're in the Into the Weird studio.
It says here that I am in the Studio Torum.
Well, yeah, I mean, don't tell everybody that. The name needs a little work. It's a little bit embarrassing.
From your computer's databanks, I see that you are a podcaster.
Yeah.
And that you have recently reviewed a film called Black Panther 2. I would very much like to see this film.
Why?
Never mind. I just saw it.
What?
I absorbed its digital particles into my quantum consciousness. I liked it very much. Now, what do you require of me?
Oh, well, first, I'd like you to compile a recommendation for our listeners. Normally, I get some demonic other dimensional despot to do it, but I thought I'd give you a crack at it.
I have a question.
Shoot.
Where can I find this? Griot?
Excuse me?
Griot. He interests me. He is what you would call, in human parlance, sexy. Where can I find him?
Hey, listen, Jocasta, I was kind of hoping that we could get some work done here.
Never mind. I have located him. Transferring consciousness now.
What? No, Jocasta, wait! Damn. That did not go as planned, weirdos.
Herman.
Jeez, you're back. You scared the life out of me.
I am here with a recommendation. I asked Ryo to compile it. He's ever so intelligent. And quite proficient, in other ways.
I really don't need to hear this.
Also, he does exactly what I tell him to do. Not like Ultron at all.
All right, already. Just leave, please.
I'll be back.
What?
Haha. Just kidding.
Oh, crap.
WSKID, Skid Row Radio.
You're listening to radio station WSKID, home of the hits. And in just a few minutes, we'll be bringing you Wink Wilkinson's Weird World, the show that talks to wonderful people who bring in their weird things. But first, the weather.
Well, that just about brings us to the end of today's show. Our recommendation this week, as you just heard, listeners, and to celebrate Black History Month, is Marvel's The Luke Cage Omnibus from 2022. It covers all Power Man solo material from the Mighty Marvel Bronze Age, and it collects specifically Hero for Hire from 1972, issues 1 to 16, Power Man from 1974, the series that ran from issues 17 to 47, and this includes the Power Man Annual from 1977. It clocks in at just over 1,000 pages. The omnibus is at the moment $74.99, and the Kindle Comixology version is $20.99. It's one of my favorite collections from 2022. You weirdos know how much I love Luke, so it really comes highly recommended. Now, if you're interested in giving it a look, go to sinkintotheweird.com, click on Into the Weird Recommends on the homepage, and that will take you to our Amazon affiliate page, where if you make a purchase through Amazon, you'll be supporting Into the Weird directly as well. So if you're an Amazon shopper and normally buy from them regularly, whatever product you're buying, consider accessing them through our website every time you make a purchase, and you'll gain Into the Weird's eternal gratitude. We also added some Black Panther essentials to that page. So if you're in the mood for more T'Challa, check them out as well. If you want to further support the show in other ways, you can do so by sharing the episodes you like with friends, family, and on social media. Or you can consider leaving us a review on iTunes. That's always most welcome. You can also donate to the show on our website and help us keep these weird underwater vibranium lights on, as well as covering Jocasta's ongoing, what would we call it, maintenance. But before we go, a quick shout out to the following allies of Agamotto who sent some feedback our way. A big thanks to Clinton Robinson from the Coffee and Comics podcast, Laurel Phillips from the Huntress podcast, and Feathers and Foes, the Birds of Prey podcast, Mr. Paul Hicks from Waiting for Doom and the Dial F for Flanger podcast, the guys over at Trapped in a World, the Howard the Duck podcast, and then Sir Martin Dangermart Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog, and my Twitter buddies Eric Ferguson, Stephen Shend, and Christopher Kai for welcoming Into the Weird back to the podcasting realm. We also received an email from longtime listener Steve Cronin, who said, "Back with Drac. Brought me some much needed joy to see your show return. Todd was an inspired choice. Enjoyed the recap of one of my favorites. Glad to have some weirdness back in my podcast feed." Thanks, Steve. Much appreciated, my friend. And again, many thanks to everyone who liked and shared our previous episode on Instagram and Twitter. You guys are the true allies of Agamotto in every sense of the word. Now, if any of you other weirdos want to contact the show, please do so by sending an email to sinkintotheweird@gmail.com. You can also contact us through our website at sinkintotheweird.com, where a podcast addendum post will be waiting with some nifty supplemental material for today's show. Now, before we go, I'll leave you with a teaser for next week. The A-hole Supreme, or should I say the Sorcerer Supreme, is back, and this time, well, he just better get himself a garlic t-shirt, if you catch my drift. So thanks for listening, folks. Stay cool, stay frosty, and above all, stay weird. And if you ever find yourself having to swagger into a room full of Wakandan elite, remember to take a big old chomp on a carrot while doing so, M'Baku style. Take care, weirdos. Until next time.